There are 50 questions of a multiple variety in case studies, and there are five where you all know if the ones are fit. The case studies are in keeping with the handout that I gave you. And the selection of organisms is pretty much the same as the selection that I gave you. So in some respects, you already have a copy of the exam. Minus the question. But let me give you a sense of the pattern of the question. The first question, let's read a little case study, and then there'll be a series of columns of answers. A, B, C, whatever it might be. And each of the lists will be subdivided into five answers. A, B, C, D. And then the first question will be, which organisms from list A could be the spacing problem? Which organisms from list B could be part of the spacing problem? Could be the second question. Okay. So we'll start off by making this sort of this house chalkboard. What are the possibilities? Now some are clearly not possibilities. Given the handout that I gave you before, hepatitis is not going to cause a lung problem. Okay? And so if I would have a list of A, B, C, D, E hepatitis viruses, and the person had a respiratory tract problem, then there would be none of that list. Okay. So basically, be aware that you're going to have to answer from list A or B or G or H or I or whatever it might be, but it's built into the question, so be sure that you read the question so you're reading from the right list. It's not too complicated once you know what you're doing. So again, case study, first questions will be broad. Which ones could possibly cause the problem? And you should have a rational reason why each one should or should not cause the problem. And you don't need to go to zebras. Okay? And so if the person has a dental abscess, and you're thinking it's going to be an anaerobic organism that's possible for the abscess, but we didn't really talk about gas gangrene in the mouth, and even though that's an anaerobic organism, that really doesn't fit. Okay. But there are some anaerobes that might fit. So that's sort of the thought process. You can make some discretionary calls, but they're like big pictures. Gas gangrene in the mouth, now we didn't talk about that. We talked about abscesses, and wisdom teeth, and we talked about tooth decay. Well, we talked about gas gangrene associated with wound infections. So if there's a question about a wound infection patient, maybe even a diabetic patient, which would give you the sense that we've got the possibility of a mixed infection, and it might include some anaerobes or facultative anaerobes. So, you know, put it within the context of the patient. But on the same token, be broad enough to include reasonable answers. Okay? And then as we go down, the next question will be refining that answer in some respects. Are we dealing with a prokaryote or eukaryote? I won't ask it that way, but I might ask it to tell you that a laboratory finding tells us that we have mitochondria, or that we don't have mitochondria. Do we have multiple chromosomes, or do we have a single chromosome? That's very basic stuff, a prokaryote, eukaryote. So now you can start weeding things out. And then we find out that maybe it's not even a cell at all. Uh-huh. So we're dealing with a virus. Now that stuff in the first exam is sort of like yawn, easy materials, blah, blah, blah. We can talk about this stuff, right? But we're using this stuff because we need to do, and that chalkboard idea, we need to use whatever information we can to get to the right answer. Okay? And that means you have to apply some of the basic stuff. Just think about it. So it's not so much, yes, you have to learn all the material we talked about, and that will get you, you know, someplace in the 60s, which you don't want to be. Now we get into the 70s, 80s, and 90s, then we need to be able to use that information. I mean, if all you are is a repository of memorized stuff, and you're one hand two duck stuff, that's not going to be too good. You can easily be replaced by a handheld device that has all the answers to all the questions in the world. But doesn't know how to make the question.
five or six or seven or eight questions for a section. And we get down near the end, but not the absolute end. We say, all right, now the organism must be, and pick the organism. Now, when you get to that point, you might want to review your answers to make sure that you were consistent in your logic. If you didn't come up with an answer that, oh, yes, it was acid fast, I know that is, it's got tuberculosis. Okay? But then when you look back at your answers, you somehow said that it was a virus in the earlier question, so that doesn't add up. Okay? So make sure that you're consistent. Broad the beginning, narrow down to the right answer. Then there's going to be a couple of questions, possibly. Now that we know that this is the patient's problem, what more can we learn about it? Okay. And I gave you in class the possibility that someone had tuberculosis and that they were an IV drug user. And now we might, even though initially the problem is the respiratory tract, we might be suspicious that they might have AIDS. So I'm not going to go back and change all my answers because that wasn't part of that first question. It wasn't part of the respiratory tract. But now we're talking about the patient again. Patient in case study 1 or 2 or 7. Now that we know this answer about them, what else might we be suspicious of? They might have that problem. And also, if they have AIDS and they have tuberculosis, what possible skin test reaction might they have for they? Say a MAN2 test that will we inject PPD into the skin. We're looking for a reaction. And the reaction is a lymphocyte reaction and gives us a red thickening of the skin with induration, medicine induration, erythema and induration. So you see that positive test. Now, might you have a positive test if the person has tuberculosis? Yes. Might you have a negative test in this particular patient because they might have really bad AIDS and they have energy. Energy is the lack of an immune response and what should be. So could they have a positive test with that? Yes. Could they have a negative test with that? Yes. Seemingly contradictory the answers, but in the context of the patient, no, that's all possible. Okay. Now, if we don't say anything about the person having AIDS, we have a person who clearly has tuberculosis, there's no discussion of anything else, don't make anything up, okay? I mean, I will lead you down the path. I will leave breadcrumbs all along the way. You don't need to throw your lunch out there and look at your own breadcrumbs and you will be a lost area, okay? But I will give you the clue. Yes, we think now the person has AIDS. So now that we think the person has AIDS, and we've already said that they've got tuberculosis, and we do a skin test, what type of results might we get? So it's a little subtle, yes, but you know, you're subtle people, you can handle it. So we have the case studies. It is a ever-growing popularity kind of questions. You will see these in your clinical era, and you'll see these as part of as a very common continuing education pattern. Okay. A lot of these continuing education things are done online now, and they just give you a case study, and they give you all the information. And you pick the right answers and you move on. Okay. So it's a doable thing, but you know, unless you actually have to sweat through an exam so to speak to do it, you really don't get your feet wet. So this is getting your feet wet. It's not impossible at all. It's sort of almost, I hate to say it, it's almost fun. I know it's yes, I understand. But it's a puzzle. It's a little bit of a challenge. It's not like stimulus response, memorize answer. This is like, you got to think about this for a second. What are the possibilities here? Play it like a game. It really is more like a game. Okay? No patient will die on this test. And in 30-some years, we've never lost a student taking this test. So, you know, everybody will live. So all we need to do is sort of understand it's a mental game of sorts. A little bit of a challenge, but not something you can't handle. It's a thinking thing. But you have to come to the game prepared. You have to know what the organisms we talked about do. And so I gave you the roadmap of the organisms and a sample of the kinds of questions that we get asked. So you need to look at that study guide and say, okay, I need to know whatever we talked about these organisms. Now, if it's not on the sheet, do I have to know it? That's usually the first question I get. And the answer is, if we talk about it in the class, it may come up. Okay? it may not be one of those, because it might say something about primary atypical pneumonia or something like that, or which involves, there's two possible answers, okay? And so there may be a question that sort of involves that, and which, you know, I can't think of the exact question on it, but there could be questions about those kinds of things that aren't specifically but related to the question. We often have mixed infections, for instance, Hago, Strep pyogenes and Staph aureus, right? Strep pyogenes is the lead organism, but then we have Staph aureus because we're scratching it if we add to it. So we might see that combination of things. But probably 90% or 87.53% of the organisms are on that sheet, okay? If I say 100%, it's going to say, well, page 7, there were all 3. So I won't do that. So I'll tell you the vast majority are the ones. And so if you know the ones we talked about in class, and you know the ones around the sheet, and you're going to, that organism is associated with that. And this organism is causing this. And this one causes a toxin. And if you know that, that information, you know which ones are listed as the facultative anaerobes and the ones that are anaerobes. And, you know, the information that we gave you, that's all I'm going to ask. I won't ask something that I didn't talk about. It won't be on a class assignment where there was 75 pages to read, and at the bottom of the 67th page, a little footnote. No, I didn't know. Something we talked about in class. Okay. So, having prefaced that, questions that you might have. Yes?
Can you just like the different drugs that you use to plan?
Drugs are not going to be a main focus of our discussion. But you know, some broad things. You know that mycoplasma doesn't have a cell wall, so cell wall synthesis inhibitors would not be appropriate. And there are a small collection of compounds, isoniazid, for example, that we use for tuberculosis. And some minor things. This is not a drug bug course. There are other bug courses that will come. The creature will be able to work on the brain a little bit more. But if that's not going to be the main focus. But knowing which ones are gram-positive and gram-negative, that's going to be important relative to the drug stuff you get later, so that would be good to know. Is it golden? Can we cash in on it? Somebody sent me, I don't know what's true, you can stuff on the internet, you know. It's, the value of truth in that is probably less than 5%. Somebody said, you know, what is this? It's a medical device. What is this? And it looks like some sort of bellows system. You know, you use on the fireplace or something like that. And apparently, according to the discussion, in the early 1900s, tobacco was thought to be medicinal. And they would use this to introduce smoke into an orifice, which gives rise to an expression about smoke up an orifice, which is medical origin, I'm afraid. Maybe we're doing this with smoke and mirrors, I don't know. You'll need us, where's our scan time for this? This is the person who brings the scan time. Not even here today. Is there an assistant who can do that? We have to go up to, I guess it's the Curry's office. He's not here. Oh, yeah. But for the secretary's office.
Yeah.
Yeah. Could you do that?
Sure.
And we need about, give us 101 over time. If you relax on the test, it's much better to be relaxed than to come in here with 2 hours sleep and try to memory dump. Because there's nothing for you to match up on a memory dump as well as having the ability to think. So thinking is more important than memorizing the last little bit of information. But you need to be able to do it. And interestingly enough, on this test coming, for some people, it's the hardest test in the course. But some people who have been struggling all along will say, I can do this. I didn't think I got 73. I didn't think I could do this. I got a 96. How is that possible? Cheat for somebody? Everybody around me got a 12, so they couldn't do it. So basically, you know, it's a mindset thing. Okay? Some people's minds are problem solving, and you need to all develop that skill. Some people are innately good at it, and some people are not particularly good at it. But ultimately, that you all have to do that, otherwise you'd be replaced by the machine. Anybody work in a pharmacy? There might be a few. One of my, just as an aside, you know that there's people out there working on problems. If you work in a local pharmacy, you notice that recently, in the last year, the people can come in and get 3 months' supply before they have to do online. Do everybody know that? I'm on the board of an insurance company. And we push this through. The members say, this is we need to do it. I should send stuff off by the email and the mailing system and have this company someplace we don't know where send the stuff. And we know that our friendly pharmacist, a face, a person that has a personality, why don't we go to Joe or Sally or whatever and get 3 months' supply with just two deductibles and all that kind of thing. And we did it. We changed it to about 140,000 people. I'm working on another one, and if anybody has any help, you can talk to me about it. And that is coupons. Okay? Coupons sound like a good deal. I'm not going to spend a lot of time, but the coupon sounds like a good deal. The patient gets a coupon from the doctor, and it's worth, I would say, $50 or $30 or whatever it might be. Okay? And they say, that's great. So they take drug A with the coupon rather than drug B without the coupon. Now, the cost a month for drug B is about $150 a month, let's say. That's without the coupon. The cost of drug A with the coupon is $547 a month. But the person who got the coupon, so they think it's a good deal. And it doesn't come out of their pocket directly because they don't pay they see the cost of the money that they pay as a copay for the door. So somehow we have to figure out a strategy to counteract that because the $500 a month is costing everybody in the neighborhood.
Clearance and flushed down the up and out.
now, but the Star Trek was a great deal before that idea. The GI tract is supposed to kill them off, but if the pH has been neutralized, that can be a problem. The vaginal flora is protective. There's a small amount of fungal organisms there, but they're not really growing particularly well because they don't grow well in acid pH. And acid pH is the product of the mucosal secretion, which is acidic, coupled with the fermentation, end product of fermentation of the normal flora bacteria. And so we have a slightly acidic environment, and that's a good thing in terms of the balance. If a patient takes, let's say, erythromycin or tetracycline because they have acne, and they take it for 6 months at a time to get rid of their problem, well, that's going to adjust the normal flora throughout the body, including the vaginal flora, knocking out sufficient levels of bacteria, which then in turn result in an overgrowth of fungal organisms like Candida albicans, and so they'll get a yeast infection. We also have certain birth control pills that will adjust the pH of the vaginal secretions, also do the same thing, making it more neutral and increasing the growth of fungal organisms. Hormonal levels can do that, particularly maybe a woman that might have a tumor of some sort that results in a change in the hormonal levels, and that will adjust the pH. So we see that there's some underlying problem often associated with pH, either directly or indirectly, to the organisms or secretions, and that will result in the yeast infection. So if a woman has repeated vaginal yeast infections, more than simply treatment of the yeast infection is the proper course of treatment. So there's obviously a commercial capitalistic approach to things, and in a commercial environment you want people to buy your product, and there are advertisements for vaginal yeast treatments that are over the counter. In fact, there was one that was common, usually around the time of your eating supper, watching the evening news kind of thing. And so we have these erectile dysfunction things and vaginal infections and all that good stuff that people are interested in when they're eating. And the one was, there's a woman and she's, and there's an old voice of another woman that says, as if she's thinking, she's going down the aisle of the drugstore, you've had this before, you know what it is, just use our product. Without really talking about directly the vaginal yeast infection. But the problem is if a woman has had it often enough to recognize the symptoms, then there's something not quite right. Okay? And that something that's not quite right could be any of the ones we mentioned. It could also be diabetes, because that's going to change the growth of the normal flora as well. We've got that secretions with more glucose than normal. So there might be something else going on. It could be medication that's taking, from antibiotics to birth control, or could be hormonal situations, it could be a tumor, it could be diabetes. We need to know what that could be is. Okay? And simply treating over the counter repeatedly. Now, yes, someone could have an vaginal yeast infection, just out of the blue, and never have it again. Okay. But if someone is having repeated infections, then something else has to be done. Final little note, obviously, one of the key factors here in controlling growth is pH. And people, women will occasionally want to rinse out the vaginal flora area with a douche. That douche ideally should be maintaining that pH. Okay? And so, vinegar and water kind of thing is really where we're headed. That's about that, right, about the right pH. And things that aren't that way are not going to be helpful. And if a woman has a vaginal odor of some sort, that can be attributed to an organism growing that's not normally growing there. Okay. And so there are organisms that can cause vaginal odors, and that needs to be checked out. We have vaginal deodorants that people are encouraged to use. Okay. Masking the symptoms. Again, we need to go to the root of the problem, solve the problem, and then everything else will take care of itself. The doping products, I don't know if that one, the odorants are big, but they go in and out of fashion. They're an over-the-counter kind of thing. And your, I just call them customers, your clients, but the potential patients, need to know that maybe we need to find out what the problem is. Okay? And then we won't necessarily worry about to mask it up. These are just a list you can review. There's not being here that we haven't talked about in sufficient detail, or we'll talk about other places. Skin is anatomical barrier, we talked about mucous membranes, temperature, pH, chemical mediators. Lysozyme is found in seminal fluid, it's found in vaginal wall secretions. Lysozyme is found in the eye and in the tear film. It's also one of the enzymes used inside of phagocytic cells in their phagosome system that we'll talk about more in detail. In the process of destroying organisms, that's one of the things that they'll produce, that is your own phagocytic cells have it, that we use it to kill. And first, it attacks the 1,4 beta linkage in the murine layer, making most gram-positive organisms very susceptible to that attack. We talked about eye infections earlier that might be powered by A16 or some other linkage, 1513, but basically some other than 1,4 beta. Because that's very effective. Inflammatory barriers, phagocytic barriers, we'll talk more about that in the course we talk about phagocytic itself. So you can see it now, but we'll see it. Specific important immunity, this is what we thought immunity was when we first heard the word. This is antibody and lymphocytes. Okay. Antibody is a serum protein. It's found in bodily fluids. And there are many classes of antibodies. It's a class of molecules. The antibody is specific to the invading organism. And it has the possibility of memory. So this is something we can stimulate with the vaccine, unlike skin or the others we mentioned for native immunity. And since it's in a bodily fluid, antibody is associated with what we call the humoral immune response. As in the aqueous humor of the eye, which is a bodily fluid. So the humoral immune response is in your fluid, it's in your serum, it's the antibody. In contrast to that, we have the other side of the immune system, and that is a lymphocyte response, or a T-cell response. And that's called a cell-mediated immune response, or CMI. So we have cell-mediated immunity, CMI, and we have humoral. We have two parts to the immune system. The specificity, it's hard to get a total grasp of that when we first talk about specificity, but to give you a sense of it, let's say the wall over there, over here on your left here, is the wall of E. coli. So when we make an immune response to E. coli, we can crudely say it's anti-E. coli, but really it's not to the word E. coli. It's to a very, very specific chemical structure. How specific? Well, we can easily separate orthometa and parapositions on a benzene ring. So we move the same group, an hydroxyl group, we move it a few angstroms on the benzene ring, and a different antibody binds to it. That's really, really specific. That's several orders of magnitude more specific than enzyme substrate. Enzyme substrate is sloppy compared to this. Okay? So if this wall was it, we might have a new response to there's a light, electrical outlet here. It's got a screw in the middle of it. It's a classic electrical outlet, two plugs, right? Little screw in the middle that holds the plate on. Now this screw got a little slit in it, a screwdriver. On the left-hand side, halfway down, there's a little nick in one of those little spots. The screw. That's the kind of target we have compared to the entire wall. So you can easily see that anti-E. coli is probably hundreds or thousands of different, really unique targets. And when a person responds to that, they respond to hundreds or thousands of unique targets. It's not one antibody to E. coli. Now, on this other side, we also have an electrical outlet, and maybe the same screwdriver is used to put it in place, and it also put the same nick in. This happens to be Klebsiella pneumoniae. another gram-negative organism. But then they share that antigenic target. Does that mean the antibody is not really specific? No, the antibody is specific to that specific target. So when we make an antibody to E. coli, there may be some crossover to Klebsiella. Not because the antibody doesn't know what it's doing, it's very specific, but that specific target can be found elsewhere. So some targets are ubiquitous, meaning the target is in many different places. So if we're using an antisera for identification purposes, we want to avoid the one that's the target that's ubiquitous. We don't want to use an antibody to that particular target because it can be shared with other organisms, and therefore a positive test would not give us the fact that it's E. coli, and we can do that. We have to find a target that's unique, and so I have to look over this time and find out what we have. This camera seems to be different. Okay. So this might be the true difference between E. coli, this side, and Klebsiella on that side. Okay. So an antibody to this structure would give us uniqueness. An antibody to the electrical outlet, even though it's to E. coli, is not unique to E. coli because one of them is not. So when we use antibodies for identification purposes, we have to be selective in what we do. Otherwise, we get false positives, or we get false negatives if we identify something that's not always there, that kind of stuff. But it's very, very specific. So some, you have to sort of visualize that so you understand what we mean by cross-reactivity, and it doesn't mean the antibody doesn't know what it's doing. It's doing what it's supposed to do. T cells, similarly, have unique targets as well. So both our cellular immune response and our antibody response is very, very, very specific. And they are both associated with memory, which makes them then possible importance relative to vaccines. Now, this active immunity can be described using five different terms in combination with two, which gives us then six possibilities. Five terms, two at a time, six possibilities. We have just quickly go through these different categories, then we'll come back to them in detail. We have active, which is natural infection. So we have natural active, natural infection. Active means you make your own immune response. Okay? And that can become natural because you're actually infected. Or it can be artificial because you were immunized. You made the immune response, but it was an artificial situation. You got a shot in the arm, that's artificial. Active, natural would be actual infection. So the category active means you make the immune response. Two subcategories, natural active, artificial active. Further down in your handout, there's passive, which means you don't make your own immune response. Somebody else gave it to you. This can be natural as it crosses the placenta from mother to child. Or it could be artificial, we give you an injection with antibodies. Okay. You didn't make the immune response in either case, but there's natural and artificial. Then there's adoptive. Adoptive means somebody gave you immunocompetent cells. Cells, lymphocytes, that can react in your body. And this can come across in mother's milk. That would be natural, adoptive. Or you can do a bone marrow transplant. That would be artificial adoptive. So we have active, you make the immune response. Passive, somebody gives you the already made immune response. Adoptive, you're given the cells, which will then react in your body. It's sort of like passive, but it's not. Remember, passive, you're actually getting the actual product. And one thing to keep in mind when you actually get the natural product, like an antibody or something, it has a half-life. And so you are protected for a little while, but then it's gone. Whereas if you make your own immune response, or if you have an immune response occur in your body with donated lymphocytes, that is a long-term, months, years, and protection. So we have natural, active, artificial active, natural passive, artificial passive, natural adoptive, artificial adoptive. Okay, so we're going to go through these step by step. A little table would help you to learn those. Natural active is actual infection. It gives us our best possible immune response. meaning that if you survive, and if you survive without sequelae, you are in a better place than you used to be. Those are two hits. Because actual infection may result in death. That's a risk, maybe not a good risk. Natural infection may result in serious sequelae, after effects. Someone could have Neisseria meningitis and get TBI and have hemorrhages and need to have skin grafts. Or maybe there's so much tissue damage that we have to amputate arms and legs and fingers and thumbs and toes and so on. So that would be not a good outcome. You live, but you pay a heavy price. Of course, that's better than dying. Is there something better than both of those? That is, without the risk of dying, or less risk of dying, or less risk of sequelae? And that would be artificial active. Okay. So in artificial active, we are trying to mimic as much as possible the actual infection without as many risks of the actual infection. Before we had immunizations for measles, mumps, rubella, chickenpox, common childhood illnesses that can result in serious consequences. Some children would get these, and because they were immunocompromised, they would have pneumonia, meningitis, die. But what did the parents do? It was a common practice. If one kid in the neighborhood had chickenpox or measles or whatever, all the mothers would bring their kids to that house. And they'd all get exposed. You might as well get it now, they say. Get it all over with. The thought process today would be, oh, keep that child away from my poor child. But that wasn't the reality. The reality was people knew that children are better to get these than adults. Common sense, common sense, scientific fact proven. The older you are when you get the child of illnesses, the more serious they can be. So therefore, everybody got it. A crude way of doing it, but that's what was commonly done. Now again, the risk is there, risk of actual infection. So we move it up a notch a little bit in terms of safety, we make it artificial active. But in order for this to work, we have to understand what's known as the correlates of immunity. What are the factors that result in protection? What's different between a non-infected person, still at risk, and a person that's been infected and no longer at risk? What's different about them? You might say they have some antibodies, you might say they have lymphocytes, and that sort of thing is the difference. So what we want to do is mimic that in effort to get that same end result with those antibodies and those lymphocytes. But we have to understand what's the weapon system, what's the virulence factor. So for example, if we're dealing with Haemophilus influenzae, Neisseria meningitis, Streptococcus pneumoniae, what factors do they have in common as a weapon system? They all have capsules. Capsules are usually made out of sugars. Sugar water, when exposed to the patient, will produce the antibodies that are protective, the opsonizing antibodies. You don't need the whole organism. All you need to do is some sugar. So that's what we put in the vaccines, sugar water. Simple. When we know what the correlates of immunity, there are correlates of immunity, antibodies to the sugars, then we can just do what needs to be done. If we know that the organism, what is the common kind of virulence factor for Clostridia tetany, Carinobacterium diphtheriae? What would be the common weapon system there? An exotoxin, okay? So therefore we can isolate the exotoxin, convert it into a toxoid, and use the toxoid as an immunizing agent, and the person then will then be protected against those bacterial intoxications. See how it works? Now sometimes we don't know what is the correlate of immunity. Then we are sort of guessing. Guessing like on an exam. Guessing in real life is a risky thing. The chance of guessing right is not great. Human immune deficiency virus, AIDS, HIV, the immune deficiency virus, obviously causes a human disease, but we have not yet figured out the correlates of immunity. We thought, oh, goodness sakes, it's got to be. We know that the glycoprotein
120, 140. We know that that particular structure is interacting with the surface of our cells, the CD4 marker. We know that happens. So therefore, let's do that. Let's block that. We'll have an antibody for that. That'll be protective. But it wasn't. So then we go, I don't know how to do it now. So we go back to the patients. Are there patients that survived this? And the answer was not too many. We have some hints now that maybe what we can do is it's a different kind of immunization. So we have to open up our ideas about immunization. A different kind of immunization might be to stimulate a suppressor population of T cells. We'll learn that we have those as well as helpers. Suppressor population of T cells that will downregulate the infected cells and keep them quiet and not allow them to stimulate the division, which means it will not allow the virus to activate and spread throughout the body. So you have a small number of cells infected, and then the virus will inside there and stay there, and it's not allowed out. Sort of like a trap. A wild animal gets into the trap and is stuck in the trap. Can't get out. You can make it so you still have the animal in your body, you still have the virus in your body, but it's not out running around anymore, and it doesn't infect any other cells. And there's some evidence that in some patients that are long-term survivors, that's exactly what happens. They suppress. As it turns out, those patients need constant exposure to the antigen. The memory response to the suppression seems to be another effective thing. But in the patients that were constantly exposed to the antigen, stimulated the suppressor response, which then kept their food. So maybe we have to have a different strategy. Instead of an active kind of immune response, we have to have a suppressive kind of immune response. But we haven't worked out that puzzle yet. So those are all theoretical possibilities. But we know the expected thing did not work because we did not understand and still do not understand the correlation of immunity. Now here we have a wood cutting. This is Pasteur is up in the upper left. His assistant is providing anthrax. He was immunizing against an agent and in the wood cutting here, and his pastor sort of overlooking the thing. And so seeing it's something to do with the dog bite, that would be rabies. What they did is they took the virus, not knowing exactly where it was, the virus was found, but they took it and they dried out the nervous system. And that attenuated the virus, and that's what they were exactly in. So they're taking this dead nervous tissue with the virus drying out inside it. So he had sort of plausible deniability. He was there, but he didn't do it, if you say it. That's the official president. Here are examples of different kinds of vaccines. Now, I understand you have a lecture course, I think it's a lecture course on vaccines, so those people interested in this can go into much more detail. And, of course, you should be somewhat interested in it because it is becoming increasingly something that pharmacists can do, that is, give immunizations. Okay. All right, so we have anthrax, and we have an inactivated whole organism for that. Cholera, inactivated whole organism. Now, we have a problem with cholera, and it's an example of agents that cause GI tract problems. You probably can tell me the answer if I set it up right. What we do with cholera is we inject you with the organism, the inactivated, the cure preparation, and we inject it into you, and the body stimulates an immune response in the bloodstream. And that particular antibody is an IgG antibody. And you have lots and lots of IgG in the bloodstream. But it's not all that protective against cholera. Why do you think that's the case?
Yeah, it's
a GI tract, right? So right. What kind of antibody is in the GI tract? On the mucosal surfaces? The one that doesn't have memory, remember? IgA, secretory IgA. So secretory IgA is not stimulated because it doesn't have a good memory response, and therefore we have a problem with this. And we have a problem with any kind of protective system you rely heavily on secondary antibodies, secondary IgAs, because the antibody doesn't remember that you gave it the shot. No memory system. Now, it works to a small degree because of something called transsubjugation. Transsubjugation is if you have extremely high, multiple immunizations, extremely high levels of circulating IgG in the bloodstream, some of it will leap across, if you get a sort of concentration gradient, will come across in the gut and offer some protection. But we're trying to develop mechanisms of stimulating it. Now remember, the natural situation was Juan and Juanita with Ebola. You remember the travel diarrhea story? And they were constantly exposed to low levels, and that resulted in a constant low level of infection. Can you think of a possible mechanism by which we can do that? We have medication that does the same thing. There are antihistamines that we use. What are they called? No, not diuretic. No, a type of antihistamine tablet that you take it now, and instead of lasting only for a little while, it lasts for a very long time. 12 hours at least, 24 hours. How does that work? Time release. So we have a way of encapsulating little granules in there, and they dissolve at different rates, and they release over time. Okay. So if we had a system of gradual release of the antigen, then we could repeatedly stimulate, just like Juan and Juanita did, because they were constantly low-level exposure resulting in low-level protection. You see how that might work? And we do it with animals and veterinary stuff. We can get away with things with animals, we can't get away with people. We can actually insert a bolus, a mass, that slowly dissolves over time, and therefore stimulates the protection that we're looking for. But we can't get people to volunteer to do that. Bend over and let's get this bolus to kind of create them. So we're working on it. But our problem is fundamental dealing with the physiology of respiratory antibody response. Pertussis. Pertussis, the word means to cough, it's part of whooping cough. So the bacterial agent is really whooping cough, Portobello pertussis, a gram-negative organism. Portobello pertussis is added to the tetanus and diphtheria toxoids, creating the DPT. The advantage of that combination is that pertussis is a natural adjuvant. An adjuvant is something that enhances the immune response. So the good news is that when we add the pertussis, which is a whole cell then lysed, so it's not like a defined part, we get the whole thing and we lyse the cell, the bacterial cell. And what the German Yiddish term is that is called is a gewisch. So we make this like a soup or a stew. So we take the cell and we just destroy it. And that, the cellular contents, the 50 pieces of the cell wall, the whole nine yards, that's what we use initially. And it gives you this adjuvancy. It enhances the immune response, not only to itself, but also to the diphtheria toxin and tetanus toxin. So as opposed to simply giving you the shot separately, three different shots, or even the diphtheria and tetanus toxoid together, you get a stronger immune response to the diphtheria toxoid and tetanus toxoid when you combine it with the toxin. That's good news, a natural adjuvant. Bad news, some people, they will take this idea of an enhanced immune response and take it to a new level, and they will develop an immune-based allergic reaction that causes encephalitis. An allergic-based encephalitis, which can cause brain problems, cranial nerve damage, and death. Oh. We got that from the shot? Yes. Okay. When we talk about genomics down the future, maybe we can isolate just who those people are for this particular adverse reaction. But it is now there's silence in the population. A very, very small number of people who bring their child in to get the DPTs, their child will have an adverse reaction to some of those. Not a great number, but some of them will die. You sign a little release as if you knew what the fine print meant. But you really don't know it, what it means in the real sense until your child has this adverse reaction when they will die. Does that make it so that we should not use this? It can cause death in some people. In the United Kingdom, there was such an outrage about it that several years ago, they decided to take it out. No longer did they use pertussis. They just gave it the theory of tonsillar tetanus toxin. And people said, see? A system that's reacted to us. We like this healthcare system. Within about 3 years, they had massive outbreaks of food and cough. Now a greater number of people are actually coming down with the disease, and a great number of people are coming down with the allergic encephalitis and dying, and the crowd said, wait a second, we need to stop this. We didn't have this before. Okay, so they put it back in, the vaccine. So there's a risk to the vaccine. The risk can be minimized by cleaning up that blemish, by having fewer components in, retaining the inaccuracy, but toning it down a little bit, and that's what we keep trying to do with this. Refining this acellular nature of the pertussis. But we still want the accuracy. We still want to protect against whooping cough. So there we are in sort of a conundrum of sorts, a problem, a public health problem. The problem is that we're going to use something that we know some children, if we don't know who they are going to have adverse reactions to it and possibly even die. Yet we still use it. The reason for that is it's a risk-benefit to the total population. Because if we don't do it, far more people will get infection and far more people will die. So it's a risk. What the general public doesn't always understand is that other side of the risk. They equate it with zero risk. I take the vaccine, I got a risk. If I don't take the vaccine, I have no risk. That zero risk doesn't exist, except in their mind. Okay, so when they make the comparison, it's simple, we shouldn't take the vaccine. But we know what happened. In fact, we had an experiment in the UK that we did it. It wasn't meant to be an experiment, but that's the way it worked. So we have to, the general public has to understand, and as you give these immunizations, you may give an immunization that results in an adverse reaction to the patient. Some of those adverse reactions could be serious enough to have long-term consequences and even death. That shot we're giving them. And they signed something. We all signed stuff, and you did your work, and they did their work, and nobody really understood the risk. But they have to put it in context. That risk is not acceptable, so I just put it out, that's the right word. But that risk is understandable. Okay? In light of the fact that we don't do it, we have a greater risk. But it is not risk-free. Very few things in life are risk-free. Just a few weeks ago, walking across the street, right out here, is not risk-free. So you all walk across the street. But sometimes we don't make it to the other side. So nothing is without risk. Okay. You have to understand the risk, and you have to look both ways, and you have to be careful. Right. But still, there are risks. So public health risks are that way. Now, there's another approach that some people take, and that is, let's see, now, everybody is protected against whooping cough. My children don't have to be because they can't get it from themselves. They don't have it. They have to get it from somebody else. So I want everybody else in the United States except my kid. Okay? Obviously a selfish, but understandable, people want to protect their children, a selfish, in a collective sense, activity. But there will be people who want to do that. They want everybody else to be protected. And there's a little interesting thing called herd immunity. It varies with the various agents, from bacterial agents to different rates of herd immunity with viral agents. But basically, herd immunity is this idea. If a certain percentage of the population is protected, the rest of the population is protected because of the small percentage is. In other words, it depends on the infectivity. If something is, if we're not really that infected, and most of the people around that person are protected, then a third group of people aren't exposed because it never spread from the person who had it initially. So if it's a low rate of infection, that'll happen. didn't break through the threshold, then we have a major epidemic or whatever it is. And so it works on the micro environment, your individual level, but as part of society, it breaks down quickly and doesn't work. So there will always be people who will essentially be freeloaders on the public health systems by saying, I don't want to get immunized, you all get protected, and therefore my children will be safe. Now, the problem with that also is their children will someplace, at some point in time in their life, become adults, and they will be living in an area that maybe is not as well protected. And some of these childhood illnesses that they're now getting for the first time, if they weren't protected as a child, are more serious. So there's a bill to be paid at some point in time. And the best public health measure is to immunize at a particular age, including children, and not to avoid immunization. Because people will always run up to cut corners and try to sneak by. So the pertussis little after down here talks about the acellular pertussis vaccine, which is one reason, less and less components. Still trying to maintain that aspect. Plague is another one. We have enterococcus, that's another inactive. Tuberculosis, we have a live attenuated BCG. BCG is Bacillus Calmette Guillain. BCG, Bacillus Calmette Guillain. And BCG vaccine is a live attenuated. What does it mean to be attenuated? Attenuated initially was, back in Pasteur's time, they would passage it repeatedly in different kinds of media, allowing the organism to adapt to a new media and therefore shed characteristics that allow it to grow in the previous media. If the previous media were people and they grew it in other animals, then hopefully when they reintroduced it back into humans again, it didn't have the ability to cause disease. What we now know is happening is that as we passage the organism on varieties of different kinds of media, we have deletions that occur, genetic deletions. So we actually can go back to Pasteur's time and follow through frozen samples all of the various deletions that occurred in that particular isolated BCG from then to now. So you actually follow the genetic code that you use, the genetic analysis of the organism and so on. So there are deletions. If all goes well, it doesn't revert back to a natural state. There's always a concern that that could happen, but it's not that easy to do. To pick up a new trait that allows it to cause human disease. So if you do it properly, you don't have any problem with that. Salmonella typhi, the organism of typhoid fever, another live attenuated. Generally speaking, living organisms stimulate a better immune response, particularly if we introduce them orally into the and there are organisms that cause a problem in the gut. So when we take the live organism and introduce it orally, then we're going to stimulate that GI tract immunity, the secretory antibody will be there, and everything else will be able to get a better immune response if we introduce it orally, particularly in agents that cause disease orally, like typhoid and polio, as we'll see in a moment. So that's the pattern, inactivated or killed kind of thing. So inactive is killed or alive attenuated, two kinds. Hepatitis A is inactivated, that's killed. Influenza typically is inactivated or killed, but we do have some live attenuated varieties. Currently, for example, with H1N1, we are using the live attenuated, which is the nasal one, right, on the mucosal membrane, and we are also using the kill preparation. Most people get the shot. We've already mentioned the possibility of Guillain-Barré with some of these, and Guillain-Barré is a possibility with influenza infection or influenza injection. We think we've taken care of it in terms of variety. We remove those factors that we think are associated with it. We're seeing a decline in the number of cases from we did from 1976. But still, you know, it's a theoretical possibility. But Guillain-Barré is a possibility with several different agents. One on here, when I think we talked about last time, the human papillomavirus. There's a concern about a Guillain-Barré and human papillomavirus, the Gardasil one. Measles, we have a live attenuated.
interesting story about that. We should have with a lesson learned. So you don't need to know the history to name the dates, but the lesson learned you need to understand. When this was developed in the 1960s, it was a live attenuated virus. We would like to immunize, for example, pregnant women and children, some of whom are immunocompromised at the age of five. So we thought maybe let's develop a kill preparation. And they developed a kill preparation. They tested it in people, and of course the clinical phases are, one, when you inject it into people, does it cause an adverse reaction? The answer was no. Two, when you inject it into people, does it produce an antibody response, which is what we're looking for. We figured that was the correlated immunity. Yes, it produces an neutralizing antibody when it binds to the surface of the virus and prevents it from invading. So then we immunize. And then a weird thing happened. Children who were immunized, when they later came in contact with the actual street variety of the virus, were not fully protected. In fact, they developed pneumonia and encephalitis at a much higher rate than even non-immunized children. We had done something to them. We had modulated their immune response. Anytime we give you an immunization agent, we modulate your immune response, hopefully for the better. You know, the memory response and all that. We had modulated these in a non-beneficial manner. What happened is that the vaccine that we used as a live attenuated, in retrospect we learned, stimulated both cellular response and the antibody response. Both arms of the immune response, CMI and humoral. The antibody response bound the free virus, blocking it from entering the cell. Cellular response destroyed the virally infected cells. So if some of the virus did make it to the target and they were replicating inside a cell, a T cell would come up and destroy that cell. So it's sort of like shooting down the airplanes and blowing up the airplane factory. You have a way of doing it. When we used the kill preparation, it stimulated antibody only. It didn't do the CMI. Remember, we didn't think that was part of the correlated immunity. So in our clinical trials, we look for antibody. Does it have a neutralizing antibody? Yes. It's a success. Let's use it. We didn't test for cellular responses. And they turned out to be not there. So now when the organism got into that person who had been immunized with the kill preparation, they produced the expected antibody response. But that only got into the free virus. The virus that made it all the way to the cell made it and was not interfered with. The body then says, okay, I did my thing, I produced my antibody response, I'm going to suppress that immune response now because I don't need it anymore. Meanwhile, the virus is still in the body inside the infected cell. But it did distort the immune response a little bit, distort the interaction of the virus and host, so that it resulted more pneumonia and encephalitis. So we had to go back and re-immunize all those children. So sometimes when we think we know, we don't know enough. So we give live attenuated. Mumps, live attenuated. Measles, mumps, and rubella, which is inactivated. See how many come here? Third and fourth here. Inactivated. So we have rubella down here, which is sometimes called German measles or hard measles. That's what we mean. It's a slightly different reaction. It's a more severe virus. And rubella is much more of a problem crossing the placenta and invading a baby. So we want measles, mumps, and rubella. We give them as one agent, MMR. So we have the BCGs and the MMR. Notice that rubella is the inactivated variety. And we're concerned about the child's birth defects and so on, so we want to make sure that the titer of neutralizing antibody is present in a woman who is pregnant, and otherwise we want to immunize the woman. Polio, Sabin, live attenuated, salt, inactivated. The original vaccine developed at the University of Pittsburgh, brought down the salt. Later, if you move to California, we'll all get the salt institute. But we have salt vaccine was basically a kill preparation. Now, he had some problems. He used African green monkey kidney cells, and when he harvested the virus to kill it and then put it in the vaccine, there was also something called simian virus number 40, SB40, which causes cancer in monkeys.
that was also in the vaccine, the first one that was made. It was also killed, but we didn't know about it until 10 or 15 years later, that we actually immunized a large number of millions of people with a dead, fortunately, virus that causes cancer in monkeys. Now, obviously, it was killed, and obviously, it doesn't have a receptor site for human cells, but that was a pretty big whoops. It could have been pretty bad, but it wasn't, so we got lucky. So that one was cleaned up, and that works really well. It stimulates a very good cellular response and a very good humoral response, but not a very great gut response, the antibody response in the gut. And so Sabin, working initially in the University of Michigan, developed a line attenuated. And people liked that right away because line attenuated was dropped down the throat with no needle, and people obviously got phobia about needles and things. So this was great. They got a couple of drops down the baby's throat and everything's fine. Now this line attenuated, again it's attenuated, it's got some genetic deletion so it doesn't cause any disease. In the 70s, way back in the 70s, and when I was in grad school, the rumor among the virologists was, it just seems a little strange, but we have these vaccine-related polio cases. And initially we said, well, what happens is that Aunt Susie has Hodgkin's disease or something, and she was babysitting, so we just gave the vaccine to the child, and there was still some of this attenuated virus around because the baby was shedding the virus for anywhere from 1 week to maybe 4 or 5 weeks in the diaper. You give it too early, replicates in the gut, okay, and then 2 days for protection. And then it just dies away. But while it's still in this weakened form, some people have had contact. Maybe someone who was immunocompromised comes down with polio. And then there were those people who were from various, usually religious groups, but there's not only religious groups, who do not believe in immunization, and they were in the community of people who were immunized, and they were maybe a 14-year-old girl who was babysitting somebody. And when they were babysitting, they would change diapers for the child because they had immunized themselves. And the 14-year-old girl can come down with it. Could be just that's an argument. But there were these small cases. People began collecting more and more data, and the numbers were not getting any smaller, they were getting bigger. Why are these people getting it? So then they began analyzing the kind of virus that was coming out of the people who got the vaccine-related ones. And Aunt Susie was the Hodgkin's disease, and the 14-year-old girl from the Amish community, or whatever it might be. And no, they didn't have the attenuated form. They had the actual virus. Did they actually get it from the child? How could that be? Things just didn't add up. Then in the 90s, somebody did a more thorough investigation, and we find out that the kid is actually shedding fully variant virus in the diaper. We didn't expect that. We thought, so then where did it come from? Oh, maybe it's reverting back. That's what it is. It did not suddenly gain the genetic deletion. In the original vaccine, a small amount of fully variant virus was tucked away in there. Most of them were attenuated, but not all of them. Give this to the baby refines this crude amount of fully variant virus, killing off, after they develop the immune response, killing off all the susceptible ones, which would be the attenuated ones, the dying off. And they're attenuated anyway, so they disappear as well. And the ones that are remaining then, in that diaper after a few weeks, are fully virulent ones. So the baby is acting like a refining step. A small percentage of fully virulent ones goes in, and a high percentage, so you get good yield of this process, like the organic chemistry class, and you get a good yield of fully virulent virus coming out the other end in the diaper. Wow. It really was a hot diaper. And so what we decided to do was, let's not give that anymore. And so we took that off the market. So currently, the only vaccine for polio that we give is the salt vaccine. We're back to using the needle because we had this problem. Now, of course, the people who make the vaccine are trying to make it better and all that kind of stuff, and probably they will be able to do that.
and probably we'll see this come back on the market. But it's going to have to go through a lot of tests to do that because of the problem of vaccine-related polio. Not only those few people who might be really immunocompromised coming down with the attenuated virus, but more of those people who got it for getting it from the fully active virus coming out of the diaper. Rotavirus. Now, rotavirus is another live attenuated virus. I think I might have mentioned this before, but we'll reinforce it again now. Rotavirus vaccine that works fairly well, prevents a childhood diarrhea in the United States that's not life-threatening. We have Pedialyte and so on, so we can deal with the childhood diarrhea, the consequences of dehydration, which are a concern, but they can be dealt with easily enough. There's only a few serotypes, so that's why we can make the vaccines like polio. There's only a few serotypes, like three. We talked about that in comparing with the epidemic of Q. Remember, Q serotypes, most people are protected by the time they get into the school age campaign. So when you see these epidemics of diarrheal, infectious diarrhea associated with the virus, that's generally going to be the second variety, not coronavirus. If you've already seen the rotavirus three times and you're protected. Well, we have this intersituation occur, as we mentioned, and we have this problem in terms of collapsing down, telescoping into the intestinal tract. As it turns out, that was probably temporal related, that is time related, but not causal related. And so it's back on the market again. Okay. In fact, I think we've got at least three different varieties of rotavirus that are live attenuated. But it was off the market for about 4 or 5 years or so. And we talked about the problems in the diarrheal belt in Africa and so on and so forth. Rotavirus. Zoster, live attenuated. This is sort of an interesting one because remember, this virus causes chickenpox and it causes a reactivation called shingles. Okay, so the initial infection is the skin reaction and the fever. And some children will develop pneumonia and meningitis, and some few will die. But most people will simply have a fever, some mild form of meningitis that is light sensitivity to a COVID, I think they headaches and stuff, but nothing serious in the long consequence, without long-term consequences. But we do have a vaccine now. So children now are routinely immunized against chickenpox, which means then that they should not, when they are in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, develop shingles. And shingles, remember, is one easily identified. You will see it in practice. How many of you have already seen it? Basically, you see blisters on half the body. And right down there, it's really interesting. They look one way, no problem. Look the other way, oh, goodness, we're hungry. And so you see this rash, it's half the face, half the forehead, one half, half the nose, half the cheek, midline belly, midline, one leg, not the other. And initially, the little blisters will coalesce and form large areas of black scabs and so on. The nervous system can be invaded to the point that it causes a lot of pain. And even after the rash disappears, the pain can persist in some patients as long as a year and a half. Most less than that, but it can be something that's a longer term. Easily treatable now. You can use the antiretrovirus for that, but there's antiviral agents for that. So it's easily done. But what we do now with people who have actually experienced the virus, have the virus in them, how can we reduce their likelihood of getting shingles? It's a little delicate. We're still gathering the information, but the initial information seems to be that if we give that vaccine to someone, we don't have a reoccurrence of shingles, or if we do, it's much milder. The recommendation now is for people in their 50s and 60s and so on to get the vaccine. Putting on the insurance cap, it's not paid for by all insurance plans and it's not cheap. So a lot of people wait till their Medicare kicks in and then they get their shot. And it's $200. That's the story of it. There's always a concern that we would somehow trigger shingles in these individuals, but we have not seen that. That's a reasonable concern, but as it turns out, it doesn't seem to be working out that way. But we're still collecting data on it. Yellow fever. Now, it wouldn't be yellow fever something you need to go into great detail about, but it does have some interesting things we need to be aware of. Obviously, this is a vector associated with this
fever may be in an area that's got a lot of mosquitoes. Yellow fever was something that was common in the United States in the 1800s and so on. And so the Mississippi River Valley was common. Memphis had major epidemics of yellow fever and so on. So it's not something that is just in the tropical climates and President Roosevelt digging the Panama Canal or something. But no, it actually happened in the United States as well. It's the sanitation thing. They have stagnant water with mosquitoes and such. But we have a vaccine for that. It works fairly well, well-tolerated, so on live attenuated, prevents the disease. Of interest here is West Nile virus. Now, West Nile virus is something that is mosquito-oriented and kills off birds. And so in the summer of the year, we see birds dying, and if there's a bird kill of some sort, the public health people look for birds and look for West Nile. And West Nile can cause infections in humans that can lead to meningitis and can be fatal. So we need a vaccine for this, we think. And they've heard about the vaccine until they realized, those cross-reacting determinants that I talked about earlier, the screw that was over here and the screw was over there. Well, we have the antigens of yellow fever virus that are you were being exposed to in the vaccine. Many of them cross-react with West Nile. And so we're thinking that if we actually get to the point, public health-wise, to need to immunize, remember there's always a risk with any kind of vaccine. So if three people in the world get it, we don't want to immunize 9 million people. Okay? So we have to look at that number. But if we get to the point where it's an epidemic, we're going to go back to the yellow fever vaccine and use that because we know we've been using it for 25, 30 years. We know how well it works. We're not going to try to develop a new vaccine for it, which means the testing of that and so on. So cross-reactivity is going to be protected, we believe, with West Nile should that come about as a problem. So we're going to use the yellow fever vaccine or do something very similar to it. Toxoid, we already talked about diphtheria, tetanus, and CPT. We know about capsular polysaccharides and so on, relative to Moffus influenza, that's here in the disease, but we don't need to narrow that down. One little note, protein carriers. We can use a protein carrier, and the carrier works, again, the Germans did a lot of early work on this, and the German term for that is called a schlepper, a helper. The carrier stimulates a T-cell response, which gives you a stronger antibody response. The crossover and the helping between the two will come up more clearly. We'll talk about the details later in the response. But basically, we have a compound, the protein carrier, to which you do not have an immune response to, stimulates a stronger immune response to the sugars. So it's a helper. It's not really an adjuvant in the same way that the adjuvant works, but it still stimulates a stronger immune response. So we use that carrier. And it gives us a better response to the sugars. One of the problems we are seeing with the sugars, particularly Streptococcus pneumoniae, we have over 23, and the slide says 23, there's over 23 different sugars associated with Streptococcus pneumoniae. And we have an immunological phenomenon known as immune dominance. Now, if we see 23 different compounds, different sugars, each one having dozens of different antigenic targets. So we look now at that wall containing one of the sugars and it has many, many targets. So we really have a lot more than just 23 antibodies. We have maybe 1,000 different antibodies to make. And of course, you don't make any antibody to yourself, right? So it's 1,000 minus self. Well, when we look at these 1,000 different targets, some are more likely to have an immune response than others. We call this immune dominance. It'll probably vary from person to person to some degree. So you will see all 1,000 of these because you won't respond to them all equally well. Some you won't even respond to at all. So we give you the second immunization with that. You have a memory response to the ones you responded to before and a primary response to the ones you've just seen. So the more antigens you give you at one time, the more your body picks and chooses amongst them and you don't respond equally to them all. Instead of giving you 23 different sugars or 1,000 different targets, if we gave you a smaller number into these immunizations, we
you're greater likelihood to be responding to a greater number. So if you gave you 10 shots instead of one, you actually have a better likelihood of responding to those things in the first shot. The problem is, in terms of efficacy, right? Efficacy is overall what is the effectiveness, taking all things into consideration. Well, the problem we have with immunization is getting immunized. And people miss their doctor's appointments, and they get behind in the shop, and the schedule goes straight up, yada, 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 it rains, it snows, they can't get out of work, they're sick, somebody's sick, they can't. All these reasons why not getting the shots. Okay? And so what we like to do is, boy, if we get you in there once in the first 6 months, pop, let's give you everything. Okay? So we'd like to give you everything, but the body's only going to respond to some things. That's called the immune dominance problem. And it's a complexity problem. We're trying to overcome that by adding adjuvants. Adjuvants will give us a broader immune response. Okay? Again, we don't want adjuvants to be allergic reactions. So there's some things we're playing with. So anticipate changes in the schedules of immunizations over time as we develop better vaccines to give us a stronger immune response to more things with a single shot. And we'll talk about some mechanisms involved in that in a moment. Hepatitis B, surface antigen, recombinant DNA technology, we talked about that. One thing to keep in mind here is that this is a recombinant antigen. It's a very, very small antigen. It's not this big wall. It's just this small thing. And again, sometimes we get ahead of ourselves. We think we understand something better than we did. When we made this, we made it very precisely, just what we wanted. But only 85% of people respond to it. We figure the other 15% is overlapping self. And so, if everybody in the room got immunized, not everybody is equally protected. To find out whether you responded or not, you really have to have a serological test to find out. And that's after 3 immunizations. If we find that you're negative after 3 immunizations, we may, just for this completeness sake, give you a 4th immunization. But the clinical trials indicate rather clearly that many people up to 6 immunizations does not respond any differently than they did in the first 3. So if you fall on that 15%, if you shave a little bit off and get a few more, but not too many more. And that's because we have a very good antigen. So we wanted something really good and precise, and in the process, we eliminated 15% of the population. This is intentionally old. This is 1999. You can go online. This changes at least once a year, sometimes twice a year. Okay, so to know what the current recommendations are, you have to go online. Even something printed sometimes is out of date by the time you distribute this. But this will give you an idea of what to look for. This is what's given at what stages. Okay, remember that efficacy argument. People do not go to the doctors on this schedule. Okay? Maybe even if they have great intentions to do it, they don't make it all the time. And so therefore, we end up being off schedule for probably more than half the children in the period. On this, we have hepatitis B, the DPT, H flu, smallpox influenza, serotype B, polio, we'll know, remember we've got the polio, we went from Sabin to Salk, back to Salk, from Salk to Sabin, back to Salk again. So we're using the field preparation. Rotavirus was in and out, and in and back in again. Measles, mumps, rubella, MMR, and varicella. We will be adding to this over time. We're going to be hopefully moving up a scale and coming into the real world relative to HPV, and ultimately we'll be immunizing both boys and girls, immune papillomavirus, to prevent, among other things, cervical cancer in women. So if you think about it, that virus, that vaccine, and the hepatitis B vaccine are two agents to prevent cancer. And we talked earlier about Helicobacter pylori, a bacterial organism that's associated with esophageal cancer. So we can treat or prevent that one. We don't treat the cancer, but we can prevent that one with antibiotics. So the whole idea of someday in the future we'll be able to prevent cancer, we can do it now. Not everything, but something. Additional vaccines. Recombinant vector vaccines. Varicella is the agent we use to prevent smallpox. The last case of smallpox was 1976 in Somalia. A I actually ran the technician that brought the case into the hospital and did their initial work lab. So 1976 in Somalia, you know, that's where the power is on, in Africa. Last case of smallpox in the world. But we continued to immunize for a long time after that. But we suspended it in the United States and ultimately suspended in most places in the world. Not everywhere, but most places in the world. This is the one that's a scarification, you know, the little spot about here on your shoulder. Because we actually take the pride of the virus and exactly what we do. And then we take a lot of stimulants, you know, a lot of stimulants virus and put. But the vaccinia virus is cowpox. And cowpox prevents smallpox because the cross grant determines that it determines the common flu. So that's sort of an unusual situation to expose you to one virus and protect you against another. It's a very big virus. The pox viruses, remember the pox viruses, are actually bigger than mycoplasma and rickettsia and chlamydia. Really big virus. It's so big that sometimes it invades its host cell, it steals the ribosomes. They're not functional, but they're in there. So there's a lot of room inside this virus. So the thinking is that we can use a recombinant vector. We take this large virus and we put into it genetic information. So that when the virus invades your cells, it goes into your cells and starts doing its thing, it unloads new information. Like maybe the hepatitis B surface antigen information. So we put that in there. So that when it invades your body, it produces not only in response to the vaccinia, which will protect you against smallpox, but also you'll be protected against hepatitis B. And hepatitis B is a major killer of the worldwide situation, so this would be a good thing, right? Well, why stop there? We do all kinds of things. Okay? So we just make a plasmid, you know what that is, right? Make a plasmid, and we insert it into a particular place where we have the restriction enzymes, the endonucleases that we have it opened up at the cleavage site. You know, the restriction enzymes. The DNA gene splicing kind of thing to stick in. We make sure that we have a promoter gene, that's the operator. And we have to have an operon kind of thing. We need to have it regulated so it's on. And we need to have it so it's going to be producing the right kind of proteins in the right sequence. We take the information from the pathogen. This might be the hepatitis B surface antigen information, but it could be anything. It could be the ability to make sugars that were associated with capture organisms in 1,000 meningitis. It could be the ability to make a toxoid. Anything. Right? If we know what a protein is, we can do reverse engineering to find out what the piece of RNA is, and then find out what the piece of DNA is, and we can make it. Okay. So this is far from theoretical. This can be done. So now we can put this on here, and now we have this plasmid that we constructed, a construct, as we say. And we infect that vaccinia, and now we have the recombinant vaccinia. We haven't done this in that scale, but this is theoretically possible now. So each step in here is doable. We just haven't done all the steps. So that would allow us to then have a massive immunization, but the problem still persists if you can be exposed to maybe now hundreds of different kinds of antigens, maybe thousands of different kinds of antigens, and you have an immunodominant problem. So maybe you'll get this one super shot, but you might have to get super shot several different times. So where's the advantage? Now that's the problem. The other problem we have with the vaccines, that this is going to be a live vaccine. And live vaccines, you have to keep the virus alive, right? And if it dies before you inject the patient, it doesn't work. That means we have to have a way of keeping it alive between the time you made it to the time you give it to the patient. That usually means keep it cold. We call it a cold chain. And that's easily enough done in the United States, but it's not too easily done in Nairobi. Okay? It's not easily done in developing world countries. They don't have electricity. They don't have refrigerators. They have ice. Okay? There's a major epidemic of measles because we had a MMR vaccine that was being moved from one side of Lake Victoria to the other, and it's kept cold on ice. As soon as they left the shore on one side, the workers took it off the ice, put the beer on the ice, drank cold beer on the trip over. As they approached the shore, they put the vaccine back on the ice again. They were happy. Everybody was happy. The vaccine was now no longer effective. So we need things to develop cold chains, and we're working on all kinds of ways to do this to develop in this country. But wouldn't it be better if we had something that wasn't alive and still did it? So, we have a DNA plasmid. You take this plasmid and you put it on gold dust. This is developed by neurotonics. It's developed by physicians. It's not even thought of by immunologists because obviously it wouldn't work. It does work, but it wouldn't have thought it was going to work. You take a piece of DNA, you just made a construct. It could be hepatitis B surface antigen or whatever you want to do. Put it on a plasmid. And then using a gun, as we call it, and we shoot these small particles of gold into the skin, pop, okay, under pressure. And when it does that, it actually gets to check and kill some cells, but some cells actually pick it up. And when it picks it up, it's actually still functional DNA. Who would have thought that was going to happen? Okay? So sure enough, it actually triggers that cell to produce the gene products that we just blew into it with a piece of DNA-coated gold dust. And so that's a DNA vaccine. So that seemed like a pretty good thing. And all the rest of this chart is how your immune response works. It looks really complicated now, but we're going to break it down in all these little pieces. So by the time we look at it again, this will be no big deal. Okay. So right now, it looks like, wow, it's crazy. Don't worry about it. It's not that difficult. So basically, we're going to stimulate this cell to produce the antigens. Your immune system will then activate. Here are the green ones and the blue ones. The green ones are the producing antibody. These are T cell lymphocytes. They become plasma cells and secrete antibody. Memory B cells, we can do it again later. These are the T cells that become activated, become cytotoxic killer cells, and kill the virally infected cells. So these are the two arms of the immune system. On this side is the humoral immunity. Timing of the humoral immune response, that is the activating and triggering of it. And this side is the cellular response, the timing of the CMI response. So we'll go through all this step by step. We'll look at the data that we're using. But we just want to look at the first part of it. So when you go to review, you'll be able to look back at this and go, oh, that was fine. So we have a DNA vaccine. We also have other vaccines where we have a vaccine that people can get a shot, so we spray things up your nose, live attenuated. We have that influenza, actually, we hope we talked about it earlier. Cholera toxin is really interesting, and if you get it in a pure form, it can trigger the penetration of proteins through the skin, a cutaneous kind of thing. So what we do is we have this, basically, put a drop of cholera toxin on, we take a band-aid that has the antigens on it, put it on the drop. Works best if we do that in two steps. Eventually we'll get it all in one band-aid. But then put it on, and the cholera toxin activates it so it penetrates the skin, stimulates your immune response, you never even got a shot. Okay. So for the people who want to avoid needles, that's another way of doing it. So we have cutaneous, we have intranasal, we have injection. Okay. There's several ways of avoiding that. And the final analysis would be the overall affectation, the effectiveness of the process is what we're looking at. Can it be done? Yes, these can be done. Should they be done? It's a separate question. And we need to know whether they're going to be effective in the whole population. It's a good idea. So that's the next stage that we worked out. But the mechanics of doing it, that's being worked out pretty easily right now. Passive immunity. This is not self-made. This is somebody else giving it to you. And we have natural, crossing the placenta, and artificial. An example there would be antisphere. So we're getting antibodies. We're getting lymphokines. That's the cell signals coming from lymphocytes. And they are doing the their message. We need that. Another word is the messenger virus. But we have been non-self-made, somebody else's immune response. The first one we look at is natural passive, so we use the word together. Natural passive, crossing the placenta, the first example of that. Okay. Thank you. Time? One month? This is birth. This is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 2 months after birth. This is months prior to birth, -1, -2, -3, -4. This is maternal mother's IgG concentration, and the baby then starts with 100%. This is the percent of the mother's antibodies. In that 1 month period of time, it's down to 50% left. So the baby was born, no longer connected to the mother, and now has 50% of the maternal level of antibodies. 2 months, it's down to 25%. 3 months, and you can see where it's going. So we lose about 50% every month. How do they get there? 1 month premature, 50%. 2 months premature, 25%. 3 months premature, so we have the same balance and strength. So what's happening is that we are born with maternal protection. These are antibodies against toxins. These are antibodies against capsules. These will protect the child against pneumonia and meningitis and so on, Moffitt's influenza. But they disappear because it's passive, it's a protein, it doesn't last long, it breaks down. You're not getting any more because you're no longer connected to the umbilical cord of your mother. A child that's born 1 month premature starts off the game with half. A baby that's 2 months premature starts off with 25% protective level. So a baby that's 1 month premature, their charge from the umbilical is different, right? It's going to be coming down here. So the time when they're actually would have been born, they're down to 25%. And 1 month later, they're down to 12.5% as well. So you might wonder why we keep this poor woman in the hospital and bed rest and everything else to get another 2 weeks of the baby inside. Because we know that every day produces more antibody that protects that baby that much longer. Plus, the rest of the body is developing. One of the latter parts of the development of the lungs. So we have a child who's premature, whose lungs are not fully developed, who doesn't have the full level of antibody to protect against organisms that capture without pneumonia and meningitis. You can see that this child is going to be at risk. So the longer we keep the baby in utero, the better off the baby will be in terms of development and having an immune response. Obviously, this is not the only way to do it, because we have another term there, and that's placenta. That's crossing the placenta. And so we have antibody that cross the placenta, but we also have antibody in a fraction of mother's milk called colostrum. So a breastfed baby has additional information, additional antibody that's added. Now the baby's own immune response doesn't kick in until after about 6 months, and it's gradually increasing. For all classes of antibodies, will not get full until about 5 years of age. Okay? And so the baby's got a low spot there, you know, someplace between 2 months and 6 months. This is when the baby's got its lowest protection. That's when the mother's milk is going to be the best. Terms of protection. Beyond 6 months, it becomes less and less important. By the time you get to a year, it's much less important. If we looked at the incidence of infection, would look something like this. So we have a greater amount of infection when the baby's immune response is lowest. The incidence of infection for a year is what we expect. So obviously formula, which can provide some nutritional material, not everything, as you might expect. expect, but maybe didn't think about technically. Mother's milk is designed for humans. Cow's milk is designed for cows. And so although they have the same kind of proteins and the same kind of proteins that are involved with carrying heavy metals and all that kind of stuff, it's not the same concentration and it's not necessarily all the same proteins. And so mother's milk is really designed for humans. And the best fed baby is the breastfed baby. Now the only caveat on there is that if a mother is taking certain kinds of medications, some medications can cross the breast milk and will then be given to the baby. Now, sometimes that's not a bad thing. If the mother has maybe a breast infection, that's a lot more common, nipples get infected and so on, again, mastitis, it seems like a big deal, but usually it isn't. But some of that medication may infect the baby. Usually doesn't cause a problem. So basically, the crossing the placenta is a concern and needs to be looked at. Crossing the breast milk is a concern and needs to be looked at. So we need to know that the health condition and the condition of pregnancy or not of women who are taking medications that will potentially have adverse effects on the baby. But not all medications cross, and not all medications have an adverse effect. So basically, we have a list there of a variety of the antibodies that we can use, as anti-serum. Now again, the use of these is going to be for treatment or short-term prophylaxis. We're not going to want to do this for long-term because it will not be a long-term protection. We're going to inject antibodies into you and they'll have a short-term protection, maybe as long as 6 weeks, quite likely less than that, depending on the agent. So if you're going to go to Haiti and do some volunteer work and want to protect against hepatitis A, the best way to do it is get the active immunization. But if you find out on Thursday that you're going to leave on Sunday, you're not going to have time for me to produce an immune response. So then, and you're only going to be there until the following week, so you're only going to be there for a week. So in those settings, what we'll do is we'll give you the antibody against the agent, in this case, hepatitis A. Or possibly you ate at a restaurant and you were now exposed. So this would be in the form of maybe early treatment, in which case we'll give you the antibody. So maybe somebody's, a worker at a restaurant has done with hepatitis A and has a public health announcement to get your immunoglobulin, i.e. antibody. I mean artificial passive immunity. So you can take a look at the list of agents there to get immunized with. We actually have snake bite venoms and all that sort of stuff. If we're using something like antitoxins, such as botulism toxin or tetanus toxin, always remember that the patient will get worse and then stabilize. That the antibody only neutralizes the free toxin and not the bound toxin. And as you inject the antitoxin, you have this equilibration that will occur in the patient. And as you inject it, there's still some binding over the next few days. The patient will get a little worse and stabilize and then gradually get better as that toxin decays. But the antitoxin has no direct effect on the bound toxin. Okay. Then we have specific acquired immunity in the natural adopted category. Natural adoptive is when we have cells in colostrum. So lymphocytes do come across in breast milk, and they do protect the baby, but we have not found out how long they protect the baby. Are they long-lasting? Do they last a year? Do they last 5 years? Do they last a lifetime? We have
are there and they are protected. So there are cells, lymphocytes, endocrine. And remember, the gut of the child, up to about 6 months or so of age, is neutral pH, and therefore the cells will not be destroyed. Okay, so little people who breastfeed, you know, beyond, you know, into the years and such, and like, it's not all that protected. It's not doing any good. Because all the antibody and all the cells are being destroyed by the now mature immune system, the now mature gut. If you destroy the antibody in the cells. But in the first few months of life, in the first 6 months, it looks pretty good. Generally speaking, the mother understands when the kid starts having teeth, that's about the time we should stop breastfeeding. And that's about the right timing of things. When the kid starts chewing on the nipples and so on and it's uncomfortable, that's when a bottle comes into play. Solid food comes into play and you move down the line into nutrition. Artificial adoptive is when we use bone marrow. Now, bone marrow contains cells known as stem cells. Stem cells are the mother of all the cells of your bloodstream. That is, a stem cell can differentiate under the right conditions to become all the cells in your bloodstream. So if a person is in need of a bone marrow transplant, what we are giving them are stem cells that will then give that person all the new cells of their bloodstream, replacing everything. Red blood cells, platelets, phagocytic cells, lymphocytes, eosinophils, basophils, they're all there. Mast cells, everything, right? So all of those cells are coming from that one cell. And so we're really repopulating that individual, reconstituting their immune system. To do that, we have to remove their immune system. Otherwise, they're liable to attack the donated cells. So when we have a transplant, a typical heart transplant or kidney transplant, we're concerned about the body, the receiving person's body, rejecting the transplant, rejecting the heart or kidney. That would be host versus graft. Okay? When we have immunocompetent cells, such as stem cells, we're concerned about that, host versus graft. But we're also concerned about graft versus host. If the donated cell is recognized that they're in a different body, they're liable to attack the recipient. So we have two things going on. Well, the heart's not going to attack the person, so that doesn't happen. But lymphocytes that derive from the stem cells could. So we have to concern about host versus graft, as well as graft versus host reaction.